August 1967, the Black Limousine. Freedom came at a price, and for a while we all found it hard to adjust to life in the outside world again. With nothing to do, no prison to house my soul, I often walked the country roads, hands in my pockets, hump on my back, and before long people meeting me head on would cross to the other side of the road and mind their own business as they passed me by. My long-lost brother and sisters were always to the forefront of my mind. I went to the local priest, the local politician, the local Garda station, the police station, all in the hopes of finding information about their whereabouts, but met with blank stares wherever I went. Indeed, they were unwelcome stares, and I was ran out of many a place, in order to leave well and good alone lest I find myself locked up in some such institution again, or even behind bars for disturbing the peace. But I vowed to visit every convent, every industrial school in the west of Ireland, and even further beyond, and I wouldn't stop until I found them. I eventually got a job at the local petrol station, watching the pumps. It was not rocket science, and rarely taxed the brain, but it was the ideal job for someone getting reintegrated into society again, and before long I saved enough to purchase a pickup guitar. I purchased a guitar in an old antique store in town, and it would become one of my prized possessions in life, a faithful enough old companion to the end. I was drawn to the green-faced guitar immediately, old, battered, unstrung, and hanging up there all alone on the wall. Old Mr. O'Hara, who ran the store, was glad enough to be rid of it, and even knocked a bit off the asking price to speed up the transaction. Carrying it proudly under my arm, I had a smile as broad as the dark River Shannon running out that creaky old door. It was a smile quickly knocked off my face, for who were the first people I met outside but Father Breheny and Bishop Nathy, parading down the street.
"Yearn a few pence," said Father Breheny, "and the first thing you do is buy that awful piece of rubbish. You're a dirty eejit, McGettigan."
Bishop Nathy glared at the guitar. It might as well have been the spawn of the devil himself tucked under my arm. Such was the scowl on his face.
"My advice, young man," said the bishop, "would be to smash that piece of junk. In fact, if you hand it over to me, I will gladly assist you in the process."
I wasn't sure what had shocked me the most. The fact that the bishop wished to break my new guitar, or the fact that he had even addressed a poor ragamuffin like me in the first place. The bishop had hardly uttered these words when Breheny aggressively made a jump to grab the guitar, but I clung to it even tighter still. In doing so, I somehow managed to adopt a rock star pose of defiance. Or maybe that's how I imagined the confrontation looking back. That guitar seemed to give me a new power, a strength I'd never known before. It was a strength I felt that could grow even more powerful by the day. Breheny must have sensed this, for he cowered away in fear, like a yellow-faced vampire before a sacred crucifix.
"We'll be watching you, McGettigan," said Breheny. "Oh, rest assured, we'll be watching you, my boy."
As I clung tightly to my green guitar, I developed a mission there and then. If the authorities would not help me find my brother and sisters, then my brother and sisters would find me. I'd practice and practice until I was the very best at my art, until the music of Fergal McGettigan was known the length and breadth of the rain-sodden isle of Ireland. As there were not many cars in the west of Ireland in those days, I'd often have to wait hours before a customer would arrive, and these intervals were well spent practicing my tunes. my boss. The rare times he was there was a decent old skin by the name of Paddy Doonan. And he didn't mind at all when I played guitar by the pumps, and went so far as to encourage me, for he was partial to a ballad or two, and would often request a maudlin song to help him purge his own emotions. He'd his own troubles in life, and the music helped give him some measure of solace. Sometimes he'd even ask me to play some blues, and though not a generous man when it came to compliments, told me that he could even see the day when I'd progress beyond a petrol pump attendant. He'd be very sad to see me go, but would not hold such talent back, if that was the life fate had decreed for me. On a dark night when a car hadn't been seen all day, I sat there strumming away, waiting for the clock to hit 10, waiting to close the rural petrol station, for it was a most lonesome spot at night. On this dark night, a strange voice filled the air.
"That's a mighty fine playing, son."
The words were curiously enunciated. It was an Irish accent, imitating what I believed to be the American Deep South. The cut of the character who said these words was even more comical still, dressed up in a Stetson hat and cowboy boots, like he'd just stepped out of a bad Western movie. Parked by the petrol pumps was a large, black limousine, a highly unusual beast in these parts. It pulled up so quietly that I'd never even noticed. Was I that engrossed in my strumming, I wondered.
"Howdy," said the cowboy. "Y'all still filling gas?"
"Yeah, still filling petrol," I replied a bit sheepishly.
"Fill her up a plenty then. Sure have some travelling to do tonight. Miles to go before me and my hoss get some shut-eye."
As I filled the limo with petrol, I noticed the windows were black too, preventing anyone from peering inside. This too was something I'd never seen before. I wondered if there was any soul in there, and I sensed there might be, for I thought I felt eyes staring at me from the other side. This machine was as big as a cattle delivery truck, and the cowboy, I surmised, could haul a whole posse of wild beasts in this monster.
"Y'all playing a band or something?"
"What?"
"Y'all just playing for pleasure, son, or you aiming to make it big time someday?"
"Me and my friends are practicing. We're hoping to start playing some gigs soon."
"Dead a fact. Y'all should take my card then."
He handed me a small square card. When he saw me staring curiously, he grinned before adding,
"That there, son, is what you call a business card. Got them printed in the old US of A. Mighty fine country is America."
The card read, "Buffalo Bill Cawley, music promoter."
"When you boys are ready to get going, you all give me a call now. Don't you boys let the grass grow under your feet. Don't just sit around gathering moss."
I wanted to ask him why he talked in such a strange accent and dressed in such a peculiar outfit, but did not wish to offend him. I guess the man knew a thing or two about showbiz and was projecting an image to distinguish and market himself in an industry known for its high turnover, even if that industry had yet to reach the bogs of Connacht, and as such had yet to turn anyone either under or over. He paid his money and walked towards the impressive vehicle. When he opened the driver's door, I tried to get a peek inside but saw nothing, or so it seemed. For a brief second, I thought I saw a pair of legs, a pair of long, silky, slender legs unclothed most of the way up. The legs were such that they could only belong to that of the female persuasion, and I could only think that this cowboy had lassoed himself a fine one. If this was rock and roll West of Ireland style, then there were surely worse jobs in life. I stared for a full hour at Cawley's business card, dreaming. I thought of those naked female legs and I dreamed some more. What more could a poor boy want than to blast out a few songs on his electric guitar, sing to the adoring crowds, and at night wrap himself up in the love of a long-legged woman?
"A petrol pump attendant,"
That's all you'll ever be.
I jumped out of my skin on hearing that voice. I was closing up shop and still hadn't recovered from the excitement of meeting the music promoter. I'd have went home earlier, only I got carried away playing my guitar, singing every song I'd ever learned, and hearing Collie's words over and over again in my frenzied head. That's some mighty playing, son.
A disgrace to your family is all you'll ever be. Nothing but a heart scald to your poor mother lying in her cold, lonely grave.
My heart was thumping now, too frozen to move. I eventually worked up the courage and searched all around a deserted garage, but she was nowhere to be seen. I shook my head and finally laughed at myself. Take it easy, Fergal, I said. Take it easy, lad. I couldn't sleep that night thinking of the black limousine that stopped outside my petrol station. It seemed more like something plucked from the depths of my unconscious than a real encounter in rural Ireland. When I met the lads for a regular practice session in an abandoned old abbey that weekend, I told them of the bizarre encounter with Buffalo Bill Cawley. This industry is all about contacts, brother, said Dixie Flynn. It sounds like you made a good one, though the circumstances were rather strange and certainly most fortuitous. Can't see how it can hurt us if we give this Cawley chancer a call, added Desi. It's about time some bit of bloody luck came our way. It's about time we got some kind of bloody break in life. Yes, it's time we stop fecking around, said the Dáil McCormack. It's not like we have anyone else knocking on our door now, is it? The time has come to play our first gig, brothers. The time has come to sink or to bloody well swim. Everyone agreed with Dixie's wise words, and buoyed by the prospect of a gig, we set into some rousing renditions of popular Irish ballads. Desi's honeyed vocals echoed sweetly around the old abandoned abbey, burned down centuries ago by Cromwell's soldiers. I marvelled that a place of such tragedy could now produce such beauty. I dreamt the souls of the murdered monks that haunted this wretched place were now singing in delight. And I further dreamt that we would soon progress from desolate abbey to the dance hall. I would indeed pay a visit to the mysterious Buffalo Bill Cawley tomorrow.